coming up on Broadway Videos. This week on Broadway, we talk with Amanda Green. We also review Kiss Me Kate at the Hat Shell, Rubble at the Fringe, and Spoon River Anthology at Chelsea Rep. That plus lots of news. Please stay tuned. Drop it, cherry red, extra room there in her bed, wrapped up in a Christmas bow. One look and you're a goner, cause she got no miles on her. You can drive her home for free. From the showroom to the stands, even fans got their plans. Everybody wants their hands on that hard body. Everybody's screaming for that hard body, dreaming that they're driving. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway for Monday, August 26, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
Hello. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist. His work can be seen at Talk and Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com, as well as many other places on the internet. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
All righty. So also with us this evening, we have a special guest. We have Amanda Green. We know Amanda from, she wrote the lyrics to High Fidelity, the lyrics to Bring It On, and the music and lyrics to Hands on a Hard Body, as well as lots and lots of other things. But Amanda, thank you for joining us. You're not even home from your summer trip yet. You're calling us from the road. Thank you so much.
I'm so happy to talk to you. Thank you.
I heard that you pulled over in Suffolk County and just ran up to a house and said, I need to use your phone.
That's true. I pulled into Walter Bobby's house, actually.
Okay. He's got a few phones, I hear.
That's right. Okay. he was kind enough to take me in.
Well, no. We all depend on the kindness of strangers.
That's right.
So tell us, tonight we are recording on Monday the 26th, but Tuesday the 27th is a big day. Tell us about your big day tomorrow.
Oh, the original Broadway cast recording of Hands on a Hard Body is coming out tomorrow, August 27th, and I'm so excited for it, and I'm so excited to share this score with the people who got to see it and with people who didn't get to see it. I co-produced it with Trey Anastasio. He's the lead producer on it. And he did just an amazing job of capturing the raw feeling of the songs and the excitement. And I'm really excited about it. And the cast sounds tremendous and the band is great. And the arrangements, the orchestrations are just superlative. So I couldn't be more excited about it.
So tell us about the process. When did you end up recording this? Was it immediately after the Broadway run, or did you take some time?
It was pretty immediately after the Broadway run, yeah. And we did it quickly, as you do these things. Mm-hmm. And then Trey and I took some time, you know, listening to it and re-listening to it and sweetening it and, you know, doing things like that and making a little magic. And he might have thrown on a little guitar solo. You never know.
Well, I can't wait to hear the score again. I just really loved it. Really, really loved it a lot. Especially that song whose title I should learn, the one about the big box stores that kind of put all the mom and pop stores out of business.
Oh, used to be. Thank you so much.
It's great. Truly great song. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. I read that you're adding in a bonus track that was cut from the Broadway show.
Yes, it's a song called The Triers, which was an early song that I wrote for the show. And something that Benny, the character of Betty Perkins that Hunter Foster played, and the war vet, Chris Alvaro, sang together towards the end of the show. And we really loved the song, and it was moving, but it kept slowing down the proceedings because of the storytelling. So we kept cutting it and cutting it because we loved it so much. You know, first it was like two verses and choruses, a bridge and a chorus, and then it was a verse and a chorus and a bridge and a chorus. Then it was like a verse and a chorus until it was about 30 seconds long, and we knew when we were licked, and we just had to get rid of it. But And it did move the storytelling along without it, but we're really glad it's represented on the CD.
Okay, let's go way back when. I mean, when do you realize you have this talent? Does your father say to you, honey, you're terrific. You're really doing a good job. Is it a case where he said, show business is really tough. Don't get involved. Take us back there.
Oh, sure. Yeah, they both my dad and my mom always said show business is really hard. Don't get involved. I started out wanting to be an actor. There was always writing going on in our family, you know, song parodies and singing at each other's birthdays and anniversaries and things like that. So it was very much in the air. And I grew up appreciating their my dad and Betty Comden and Steve Sondheim and Sheldon Harnick and all these people whose musicals I grew up with and grew around. So I feel like it was always sort of there. But I went to acting school, and that really wasn't happening for me. I wasn't getting jobs, and I thought, I can't do this. And I started writing songs just sort of by accident. I had a friend who was a songwriter, and we wrote one song together, and I was sort of intoxicated by that, and I started singing a couple of my songs in cabarets and sort of grew from there. It wasn't until I went to the BMI, joined the BMI Theater Workshop, really just on a whim, that I really thought, wow, theater is what I love to do and where I feel my home.
Well, actually, Amanda and I performed together in a sense because I was in the Gay Men's Chorus when we did a Salute to Bernstein that was hosted by Comden and Green, which was kind of amazing. And you came in, I think you sang, was it I Can Cook Too?
That's right. That's right.
So that was, that was like late 80s or early 90s. So
that's right. Yeah.
Amanda, do you recall the first show of your parents, either one of your parents that you saw? Did you see Applause?
See Applause.
Uh-huh.
I was a wee
Yes, you were. Yes, you were.
But I was very excited nonetheless. And it was fantastic. And I certainly remember being backstage and just thinking it was the most thrilling, best thing I'd ever seen in my life. I mean, I just was so excited.
So, in fact, did you see it more than once?
I'm pretty sure I did. In my memory, I did. I don't know.
Did you then see your mother do On the Town?
I did. I saw my mom do On the Town. I thought that was amazing. And I saw her do Prisoner of Second Avenue a lot. And I remember hanging out backstage there and the stagehands teaching me how to play poker. I mean, I thought there was no better place in the world to be than, you know, watching a rehearsal or backstage during a show. So I was sunk from an early age.
To these days, do they still play poker backstage in a Broadway show? Are they still doing that?
I haven't seen them, but I bet they do if there's time.
Okay. One of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my life was that not too many years before they left us, Comden and Green did a revival of A Party with Comden and Green at Joe's Pub. It was not long after the Public's production of On the Town. I think that was the sort of the connection there. And that was, I mean, I'll never forget that as
I
long as
I was there, and it was incredible. Yeah. It was incredible, and it was typical of them and sort of the magic that they created on stage and their joy of performing that unduplicatable. I don't know the word. their joy and their genius at it was.
And the energy of people, you know, one quarter their age, just amazing.
I know. Yeah. I was with them once in Nashville. They were performing at the Ryman Auditorium, and it might have even been after that. And they were on a roster of like country legends, and I'm still not sure why they were on that roster. It was like Loretta Lynn and all these heavy hitters and them. And I remember my dad being sort of frail and sleepy, and I thought, oh my God, how is he going to get off this? And everybody was in their jeans and cowboy boots, and Betty was in her Bob Mackie gown, and my dad was in his tuxedo because that's what they wore every time they performed. And when they went on stage, they wiped the floor with anybody who came before them and after them, and had five encores. You know, so they were really amazing.
I want to ask a very specific question about Hallelujah Baby, which you then worked on when it went to the George Street Playhouse and then in Washington. Mm-hmm. I noticed you changed the lyric in My Own Morning, and
wow.
I was say that you don't remember doing this at all, I'll understand entirely.
No, please.
But I thought it was very clever that you eliminated a certain couplet, because and the couplet is, "Where every hour is golden, no one to whom I'm beholden." And even when I was seeing Hallelujah Baby try out at the Colonial Theater in Boston, I thought, you know, part of the point of Hallelujah Baby is the fact that these are black people who have not had the advantages of great education. And the idea that she's saying to whom struck me as a little too rarefied for her. And that was the only lyric you changed in My Own Morning. Did that bother you the way it bothered me? Is that why you changed it?
I did it. Well, I changed a couple more, but clearly not in any way, which is good. But yes, I agree. Arthur thought that it was a little too rarefied speech, and that she wouldn't speak that way. And he wanted the take on the character. He wanted her to be more aggressive and grabbing for her happiness, because he liked women like that, as we know. You know, so he felt it was a little too pretty for her, and not something that would come out of her mouth. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One thing I love about your lyrics is the way you're able to write colloquial speech lyrics. And it seems so natural, even in the case of a Bring It On, where you're dealing with very young characters. And it just, to me, it seemed extremely natural. Do you spend a lot of time around young people? Is that just?
Well, I have two stepdaughters, so I do.
Okay.
But that's one of my favorite things about, I think that's why I'm drawn to being a lyricist. I love colloquialisms, and I love, Hands on a Hard Body. I love the challenge of writing lyrics that would speak the way these characters would speak, and Bring It On, I got to have so much fun, you know, with words like uneducated and breastless, and all sorts of fun things, and high fidelity, certainly the way those guys would play with language. So I think that's your job as a lyricist, and I think my fellow lyricists and I, relish those kinds of colloquialisms.
Well, I think that's great, because sometimes, when older people try that, it can seem a little forced. But
you bet.
But
you
not bet. Oh, not in New York. And with with Lin-Manuel Miranda, I'm sure that was that looked like it was a really great partnership there.
It was really fun. Yes, we ended up. You know, it began with, as we said before, each of us sort of in our corners. He was assigned certain songs, and Tom and I were assigned certain songs, and then we sort of tentatively wrote one song, the three of us together. He had one section, we had another, and then as time went on and we all the show evolved and our friendship and partnership grew, we all felt comfortable jumping on each other's songs, and all the three of us being in a room and writing, and even be with Jeff Witt, the four of us in a room, and certainly Andy Blankenbuehler. So, yeah, it was a great collaboration.
And a very, very good show. It kept me guessing all the way. I was so impressed with the actress who played Ava,
Elle
McLemore, because really, I thought she was on the level, and you people kept me in suspense longer than All About Eve kept me
so
in suspense,
glad.
That really impressed me. And when she came out with that lyric, it's something like, "I'll have a trophy and all you'll have is friends." Whoa, what a line. That's yours, congratulations. If it's not yours, pass it on to whoever wrote it. But
that was mine, and I enjoyed it.
Good for you.
Very much.
Good for you. It told us so much about her, So it was one of my favorite lyrics of the season. So my hats off to you.
Especially with Bring It On and Hands on the Hard Body, they hit Broadway, a few months apart. What was the scheduling like for you? Was actually Bring It On were you working on that before Hands on a Hard Body, or were they concurrent?
The way these things happen is that Hands on a Hard Body took a long time, and so Doug Wright and I had been going after the rights, and I think we'd gotten the rights and we're just beginning to get serious about the writing of it when I got Bring It On. So the two of them sort of dovetailed, and I would go from work on one for a couple of months and then go work on the other for a few months and go away with one and then go away with the other. So I certainly never, I didn't plan it that way, but that's the way it worked, and it ended up working pretty well. There were a couple of times when I was at a log jam, you know, like writing both at the same time, but they seemed to complement each other. They were so different that one was sort of a break from the other in a way.
So I see the Scott Miller at New Line Theater in St. Louis, which is a really good theater, is doing Hands on Hard Body. I don't know if you know that, but it's happening.
I do, and I think like six other theaters are doing it this
good.
Year. But I'm thrilled that Scott is doing it.
I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah, it really deserves a big life. I'm so, you know, we're all disappointed it didn't last longer on Broadway, but yes, really thrilled that it will.
Do you think any of these any productions that are out there will actually give away a hard body? You know, have a contest.
Give away a hard body?
Yeah, like have some sort of promotion.
That's a very good idea.
I thought they should have done it on Broadway, you know?
Sure. Give away a hard body? Well, that would have been a good promotional thing.
Yeah, so, I mean, Ford, nobody at Ford stepped up to give you an F-150? Come on. Best-selling car in the nation? So.
Well, no, because it's a Nissan truck, so Ford.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we get Nissan to step in there and do that as well. But it's... But that would be awesome. Amanda, I wanted to ask you, because you're in a unique position to have insight into theater in the past and present as being a writer and having grown up in the theater. How has the way in which the internet become such a so close to the writers and the performers and things like that changed, if any? I mean, do you get instant feedback? And I mean, I think that I've seen you on various chat room boards and things like that in the past.
I think it's harder to, as obviously it's harder to be out of town and working away from, you know, Broadway's eye, you know, because there's always someone there, and it's harder to, you know, keep New York critics at bay when you're trying something out of town. I do, you know, I have been on the chat boards. I do not go on the chat boards when I have a show.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't need to know what they think, because I have a lot of other people who I know and trust telling me what they think.
Yeah.
So, I do not, I rely on that. I don't think that's good for anybody to,
sure,
to tap into when the, you know, actors are, I think, but there's no doubt that it's an influence, you know.
Well, no, not so much the negative part of it, but so much the positive part of it, of really big fans that come out to support. And
oh, that's wonderful too. Yeah, absolutely.
Surely, you know, there's nothing meaner in the world than the YouTube comments. You know, the people that comment on YouTube boards seem to be a particular breed of mean people.
right. Absolutely.
So I want to mention again, because Dan will shoot me if I don't, that you guys have a performance and CD signing up at Barnes & Noble on the Upper East Side at the 86 and Lex store on Wednesday, September 4th at 7 p.m.
That's
for
right.
Hands in a Hard Body, which was being released by Shikaboom.
That's
and
right.
Tomorrow, and you can get it at your favorite outlets, your Amazon.
Yeah, and Keith Carradine will be singing Used to Be there. So, and Keala Settle will be there singing her lungs out.
Oh, so, she's
and,
so great.
Yeah, John Rua and Kathleen Monteleone and Jim Newman and a bunch of other people. So that'll be great.
Excellent.
And at Birdland, I'll be at Birdland September 29th with like 8 people from the cast and 5 of the original members of the Pit, including Pedal Steel. So it's going to be a great concert.
That's September 29th?
That's right. That's right.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. So, Amanda, thank you so much for joining us and stopping off at Walter Bobby's.
it was my pleasure.
You know,
hopefully it's his pleasure, too.
Yeah, tell him that we'll have to have him on soon, too. Okay?
I will.
All right. You have a great night. Thank you so much.
You too. Thanks, guys.
I've
Bye.
I've never been the kind of guy who put his faith in luck. I was stubborn. I was patient. I wouldn't leave without this truck. My daddy always told me, don't wait for your lucky ship. You can nab grab it, go and grab it. Just don't ever lose your grip. If you want something, keep your hands on it. Hold it close to you, don't let go one bit. Could be someone else, may have plans on it. So if you want something, keep your hands on it. Just keep your
Peter got a chance to get down to the Fringe and see Rubble starring Bruce Valanche. Peter, tell us about that. What did you think?
Well, this is a very funny play, and Mike Rice, that's R-E-I-S-S, who has done a lot of writing for The Simpsons, did it. This is about an aging writer, and that's who Bruce Valanche played, who has pitched ideas in the past, and every time he goes to pitch a new idea for a series, unfortunately, he finds less and less enthusiasm for it, but he suspects that much of this has to do with his age, that they just don't want old people writing, that TV is a young person's medium. However, we learn that the studio has a lawsuit pending, and they've got to hire somebody who's a little older to prove that they haven't been discriminating, and so they really do give Bruce a chance. However, they don't like his series idea, which is about the Pope has a brother who's a drunk, a wastrel, you know, and it's terribly embarrassing for the Pope to have this guy hanging around. Think of Billy Carter during the Carter administration, that type of thing. And so you think it's going in that direction, it's going to stay that way, and it's going to be a real conversation about the value of TV and all that kind of business. Not at all. Don't forget the play is called Rubble, because suddenly, you know, Los Angeles, there's an earthquake.
Oh, my God.
And as a result, for the rest of the play, Bruce is covered in rubble. He just sits there, and there's a whole mass of, like, ceiling stuff on him and drywall and what have you. I mean, that's it. And what he does is examine his life. And some of it may be a hallucination because Jesus Christ shows up in it. And it goes on like that. It's really freewheeling. It's a lot of fun. And one of the things that was really nice was seeing Jerry Adler in it. And Jerry's a real old pro, needless to say, and to see him play the agent, Bruce's agent, whom he calls and says, look, get me help, you know, and the agent says, yeah, I'll get around to it, you know, and doesn't do anything, you know, oh, yeah, I meant to call, that's right, you know, so an occasional lapse, no question, some lines don't fly, and what I really found interesting, at one point, a line from Jesus Christ Superstar was quoted, prove to me that you're no fool, walk across my swimming pool, and nobody laughed. It was very interesting. One person laughed. Excuse me. You know, how I know one person laughed? Because
it was you.
No, because the actor broke character and turned and said to the audience, he got it. You know, so I mean, really, it's very interesting to me that show is being forgotten as time goes on, when, of course, it was such a big deal back in the 70s. So anyway, a lot of fun. I was so glad I went. The place was packed, and I have a feeling that has a lot to do with Mr. Valanche's reputation and fan base. This was at the Players Theater on McDougal Street, and boy, they were packing them in. So I hope it has a future. It really deserves to. And he was wonderful, and so was Jerry Adler. They were all very good. The other people had to play a million roles, of course, you know, the people in this hallucination. But I had a hell of a time.
That's great. Peter, anything else from the Fringe coming up for you, or what's your plans with that?
No, truth to tell, I've been doing a lot of traveling and have been terribly busy, and I think that's the only one I got to see, you know, so, you know, I used to say the 2 months of the year that I loved best were May, when everything was happening, and August, when nothing was happening. Well, that's changed. Now everything happens in August, too. So I'm afraid I did miss a lot by not attending more. My intentions were good, but, oh, have I been busy.
Tell me, Peter, considering the bit about him being, you know, buried in rubble, were there any allusions to Happy Days, the Beckett play?
Not a one. Not a one. But that's a very good point. Sure. I mean, there's no question that the lady in that play is buried up to her neck as well. You know, I really don't believe there was a single reference to that whatsoever. I may be wrong about that. There may have been some subtle thing that I missed, but I don't think so. I don't think so.
Sounds like maybe more different types of references.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
Yeah, the strangest thing, you know, I try to pull together as much information on the show page as much as I can for this. And so I found rubbletheplay.com, which says a new comedy from the Emmy-winning Simpsons writer Mike Rice. And it says Alvin, an aging comedy writer with one last shot at network. In a networking meeting is trapped under rubble in L.A. by an earthquake. And it gives the performance dates in a Players Theater, McDougal Street, directed by James Valetti. And it never mentions Bruce's name.
Oh,
that's like I said, I hadn't even heard of it.
That's so strange.
Yeah, I wonder if it was a late, if he joined it late.
By the way, what's also interesting is they establish quite often and early that this character he's playing is heterosexual. So that was a nice change of pace. You know, Bruce has always been out and, you know, he usually plays gay characters when I've seen him in plays. And it was really nice to see him playing a straight guy. It was good.
Good. All right. So we're going to take a trip up to, what is it called? The Hatch, Michael?
The Hatch Shell.
Hatch Shell, where Michael got to see Kiss Me, Kate and our beloved Mark Kudish. No, Carrie O'Malley and Mark Kudish. So, Michael,
Mark's always been lovely to me. So
he know. I adore Mark Kudish. And,
so, The Hatch and the Hub. Go ahead.
Yes. Yes. It's the first actual performance I'd ever seen at the Hatch Shell, which is on the beautiful esplanade of the Charles River in Boston. And but it's famous, it's world famous as the site of the Boston Pops concerts, 4th of July concerts, which are telecast, you know, from there. So a lot of people have seen it, even if they haven't been there. And this was a very, very good, amazingly quickly put together production. We had Carrie O'Malley, who played Lily Kate, as our guest, I guess, two weeks ago, right? Wait a minute. Was it last week?
I think so.
Yeah. Carrie was.
I mean, see, that's how incredible it is. And she said when we spoke with her last week that was going to be her first day of rehearsal. And the show was one night only on Wednesday night. And this was not just a music stands concert version. This was quite elaborately staged, a lot of blocking and a lot of choreography. So it's really amazing. And I'm telling you, I mean, there were occasional moments where it seemed slightly under rehearsed. You know, someone would flub a lyric or a line just a tiny little bit. But you would never know that they only had three or four days of rehearsal. Absolutely incredible. It was a co-presentation of the Commonwealth Shakespeare Company and the Boston Landmarks Orchestra. And it was, as I said, quite fully staged. The other interesting thing about it was they did, it seemed to me, almost the entire book. And even more interesting, this was the original version of Kiss Me, Kate, which I don't think has been done very often since that Broadway revival incorporated quite a lot of revisions in terms of the text and the score. So I was really pleased to see, because who knows when or if I will ever get to see the original version again. With the fabulous original orchestrations played by a 37-piece orchestra, as Carrie had promised, and she was absolutely right. Carrie was fantastic as Lily Kate. We got to speak with her a little bit afterwards, and Gerard Alessandrini was in my party, and we all commented on how it really was the first time we had seen her do a full-on soprano role. And she said, yes, she said, you know, I actually you know, spoke with my voice teacher and said, do you really think I can do this? And she said, yes, I think you can. I guess it's just part of her voice that for whatever reason she hadn't been called on to use in most of her, you know, her high profile things that we know her for. But she sounded terrific. And Mark Kudish, I'd always thought would be perfect casting for Fred Gray and Petruchio. Apparently he came close to doing it several times and never did for one reason or another, but he was just fantastic. You know, he's just perfect vocally and physically, and he's such a good actor and such a good comedian too, a dry wit comedian, I would say. So he was perfect. The other people were, you probably have never heard of any of them. They were all fantastic. They were, I guess, up and coming local Boston people for the most part.
What about Fred Sullivan? Was he in it? I thought I heard he was. Does that ring a bell?
No, I'll give you, let's see. Jake Berger was Harry Trevor Baptista. Michaela Donovan was Lois Lane Bianca, and she was really fantastic. Very cute, very sexy. Mm-hmm. Jake Novak was Ralph. Sarah Schock was Hattie. As I may have mentioned, I guess not to you guys because we hadn't talked about it, but she was not African American, so I guess that was an example of colorblind casting in the other direction. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Joe Aaron Reed was Paul, and he is African American, and he was terrific, doing a really great version of Too Darn Hot. Andrew Burnap, really, really perfect as Bill Lucenzio, and I forgot how in the original version, he doesn't have a whole lot to do. They kind of beefed up the part for the movie. But other than Bianca, I mean, that's his only solo. I think there's some dance stuff that's in the original that is not in later versions for him, because it was Harold Lang who created the role and he was.
Yeah. He of course has to sit there while she sings Why Can't You Behave and sing that one line at the end, you know?
Right. Exactly. Well, that's another. And then in the movie for Always True to You in My Fashion, they made that much more of a duet between the two of them, which actually to me makes more sense, but not in the original. So that's interesting. But anyway, what he had to do, he was great at. Brian Robinson was the one of the gangsters. Brian Miner was Gremio. Andrew Frank was Hortensio. And that's the list I have in front of me here. Yeah, you know, it was great to hear the original Sam and Bella Spivak book, unadulterated and unchanged and unquote-unquote fixed, which it does have some problems, that book. But by and large, I think it's pretty terrific. The Harrison Howell character gets a little tedious, I think. The guy who comes in and is going to be Lily's savior, but then she realizes that she'd probably be miserable with him, as Fred points out. But anyway, I'm so glad I saw it. It was, you know, and of course it's always lovely to see anything like that in an outdoor setting, especially if it's done well. So it was nice.
You know, the irony is I just found out yesterday that in 1963, Bella and Sam were going to join Cole Porter again to do a musical about Gertrude Lawrence.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm doing research about the 63-64 season, I found out that ABC Paramount had joined forces with Julie Stein to do three musicals. One was the one we know as Fade Out, Fade In. The other two didn't get on. One was The Ghost Goes West. I remember hearing about that at the time. But the other one, Mrs. A, based on Richard Aldrich, mm-hmm. who was once married to Gertrude Lawrence, his biography of her, Spiewak and Cole Porter. Now, looking back on it now, Cole Porter had 15 months to live. I really don't know how seriously anybody took this, but nevertheless, there it was printed in Billboard that it was really happening. So that's very interesting to me.
Well, had Sam and Bella written it, I can pretty much guarantee you that the script would have been a lot better than Star, the movie that was eventually made.
That's a tough one to yeah. Yeah. Those were not the happy times watching that movie.
No.
So on, I guess, Monday or Tuesday, I got an email from Carrie with a picture of the Kiss Me, Kate score, the cover page signed by Patricia Morrison, and said, "To Carrie, I know you'll be a lovely Kate."
Wow. Wasn't that great?
Oh, how lovely, how fabulous.
So Patricia had sent that off to her. And Carrie is finished up her concert and is in Pittsburgh now, shooting her A&E pilot right now, mm-hmm. or series. So, my goodness, very, very
good. She got entrance applause.
Oh, good.
Now, her family was there, but it sounded like a lot more than her family. I think people do know her there, and I think she's...
yeah.
And she had, as we mentioned, she and Mark had sung the national anthem at the Red Sox game a few days before, so maybe that was extra publicity.
It's great when those things work out like that. So that's great. So Michael took the rest of the week off, his rough week, and went up to Provincetown, was it?
Yes.
And didn't see any more theater, so we're going to ignore you for the rest of the podcast, okay, Michael?
No, but let me just say, Megan Hilty was there while we were there, and we thought we might try to see her, but even if we could have scheduled it, both of her shows were completely sold out. So,
good well, for her. You know.
That's nice to hear.
Yeah, you know, the cast of
Smash,
you know, lives on, you know.
It does.
You know, I often wonder about which are the shows that are going to be the launching vehicles. You know, you look at like the original cast of Rent and how many of those people went off to do wonderful things. And, you know, the original cast of Chorus Line and how many of them went on to do wonderful things. And other casts where you sort of don't ever see those people again. But, so Peter got a chance to see Spoon River Anthology at Chelsea Rep, and I remember reading that in many an English literature.
Did class. You?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think we all did.
Yeah, many times. So Peter, why don't you tell us about this production?
Well, there is a tale to be told. As I may have mentioned, I'm working on this book on the 63-64 season, 50 years ago, what Broadway was like then. So anyway, a few weeks ago, I get this email out of the blue from an actress saying, "Hey, everybody, I'm doing Spoon River Anthology." And I said, "Oh, great. This is wonderful. I'm so happy because while I have the long playing record, I don't have a turntable that works anymore. So I can't find anything about this show. And what a break that Spoon River Anthology is going to be done." Okay, fine. So she gives me the number of the person to call, and to be perfectly frank, I forget all about it. All right. Saturday night, I'm eating dinner, and I'm bringing with me, which I'm carrying everywhere, the best plays of 1963-64, because, I'm just looking for little things to that might lead to bigger things, and suddenly my eye falls on Spoon River Anthology. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, my God, I forgot all about that. Oh, I hope I didn't miss it. And I check. And I find out that it's this weekend and this weekend only that I'm talking about. This is Saturday night, and this is one of the three performances they're going to do. That's all they're doing, three performances. Oh, my God. Now, I hope it's close by. I look at my watch. It's 7:13. You know, I mean, oh, my. Is it in Brooklyn? Where is it? And the theater is literally two blocks away from where I am now. So I thought, heaven on earth. This is great. Okay, I am so happy. So, in fact, I even have time to go home, drop off the book, you know, before 8 o'clock, you know, so on and so forth. So I get there around 7:40, and wouldn't you know, what I didn't check was the time it started 7:30. So I'm late, and I walk into this room, and that's all it is. It's our room, and I'm telling you, people are standing around. The whole audience is standing, too, because they're doing an environmental-type production where you're actually in the graveyard and you're going from gravestone to gravestone to gravestone, that type of thing. You know, so, all right, this is not quite what I was hoping for because I'm taking notes. You know, I mean, I'm figuring at least by taking notes and writing down lines of dialogue, I will then be able to know what selections they did. Because on the internet, believe me, you cannot find out who said what poems. But at least this way I can find out what poems they chose. There are 244 of them in Spoon River Anthology. I guess I should have said by now exactly what the show is. It's based on a book by Edgar Lee Masters, 244 poems. It takes place in Spoon River, but it takes place in the cemetery. And people speak from the grave and tell you about what it was like to grow up in Spoon River. And by the way, it wasn't so hot, because living in a small town, often means, not always, but often means you're going to run into some small-mindedness. And a lot of these people, you know, didn't mind their own business and had a lot of judgments on people in the neighborhood because they don't have any theater there, you know. So as a result, they look for any type of entertainment they have. And, you know, paying attention to what your neighbors are doing turns out to be the type of theater they do. So anyway, I'm taking notes like crazy, so on and so forth. I didn't get a playbill because I came late. And suddenly at one point, I noticed the guy next to me has his playbill. And I see in the front, as developed by Chelsea Rep and the Actors Studio. I think that was the name. I know the Actors Studio sounds like something else entirely, but the Acting Studio it was. That's right. And my heart sinks because I realize what I'm seeing is their adaptation of Spoon River, not the one I need, but their adaptation. Well, the thing is, too, this reminds me so much of Here Lies Love, where they push you around. Over here. No, don't stand there. No, over here. It was very well done for the 20 minutes I was there, but I cannot take being shoved around by people saying, you got to stand here. You cannot go there. You must stand. Same thing with Here's What I Love. They drove me crazy. I understand that a lot of people must think this is the most exciting thing in the world, to go to the theater and not have to sit in the seat and follow people around. I mean, you can't get that at the movies. I understand. I understand the appeal of it. It's not for me, and all of a sudden, by 8:15, I was in the night air after thinking I had really solved a problem with this book. What happened? I still have to somehow get in touch with Spoon River Anthology, however I can possibly do it. So that's my sad story about Spoon River. However, if you like this type of thing, I am telling you the people did a lovely job with it. The acting was very, very nice. Very, very nice. So, yeah, I'm done.
All right. Peter, I was thinking, at least they didn't make you clap.
That's right. Right.
Well, yes, that would have just been rub salt into the wound, right? But Peter, I'm a little unclear. In other words, you, for some reason, you want very much to see a production of the version of the established
right.
version of it.
Right. Yeah, the Charles Aidman put together back in 1963-64, which starred Betty Garrett and Joyce Van Patten. It started out as a small little production in Los Angeles in a 40-seat theater, and little by little, you know, gained momentum. It went to UCLA. Joe Cates, the producer, saw it there, said, we're taking it in. who would think that a show like this, I mean, think about this. They went to the Booth Theater. They got thrown out of the Booth Theater because another play was coming in, which, by the way, lasted one night. And they moved to the Belasco. And they stayed. The total run was 111 performances. They involved a move, and yet they still made money. Isn't that amazing? Which you could do that then? Because the budget to get the whole thing there, six actors, no set. And when I mean no set, I mean no set designer even credited. Four benches, two chairs, and a lectern. You know, usually I've seen shows like that where they credit a set designer. You know, not this time. $35,000 of what it costs to bring it to Broadway. They must have put everything in a U-Haul and just drove across country. and there they were. And it made money. Could that possibly happen today, that you could make money with Spoon River Anthology, people reading epitaphs? I mean, you know, come on. You know, it's amazing. And get a cast album. And there was even a TV production in 1980.
Right, right.
Oh, you know about that? I did.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
Do you? Yeah, I can't say that that was the case. So,
anyway. You know, it's interesting, Peter. I worked for a couple of years part time in the theater circle shop next to the St. James Theater. And they have, you know, quite a large selection of plays. And I remember, I think it was twice. It was at least once, but maybe twice. Someone came in and said, I want, do you have Spoon River Anthology? And I said, yes. And I gave them the script. And they said, no, we want the book.
Oh, how funny.
And I said, are you sure you want the book? Because that's not, you know, I mean, the book is just, but maybe it was either these people or somebody else who wanted to put together their own version.
Yeah, I assume it was simply, you know, they wanted to do their own version, which is perfectly fine. I mean, that, you know, and if they had let me sit down I would have stayed for the whole thing. I really would have, because it really was very nice. The costumes were meticulously put together, and they casted very well. You know, crusty looking types from the Midwest. You know, that type of thing, and so it was very effective. But leave me alone. You know, I mean, it's been a hard week. You know, I can't be pushed around. Just cannot.
It does sound awful. We should note that there are several shows that require people moving around, but they don't tell you where to go. It's up to you. Like, for example, Sleep No More, and back in the day, Tamara. You know.
Yeah. So yeah, I love Tamara. Yeah. And I saw Tamara in Los Angeles, although it wasn't as good as it was here. And Tony and Tina's Wedding, of course. You know. Tony and Tina's Wedding was really smart, because what they did, if you wanted to partake, oh, they played with you like crazy. But if you just want to sit down and be left alone, they didn't bother you for a tenth of a second.
That's true.
You know, and as a result, you know, I think that's something that every one of these people should think about. You know, if you don't feel like playing ball, you paid your money. I mean, all right, I didn't, but you paid your money. And as a result, you know, you have the right to enjoy yourself the way you want to enjoy yourself, not the way they demand you, quote unquote, enjoy yourself.
But what would Dame Edna say?
Would she? Yeah. That's a good point.
All right. So in the news this week, we have another production of Macbeth. This time, director Rob Ashford is going to have Kenneth Branagh at the Park Avenue Armory, which, where did we see at Park Avenue Armory last season? Something was interesting.
I don't know if it was last year. I think it was a couple of years ago. Company came in.
Yeah, that was it. You were right. So another Macbeth so quickly. Michael, what do you think?
Well, as I said, I just kind of wish they could be spaced out a little bit more. But, you know, public domain, producers love it. I mean, we just had Alan Cumming's Macbeth, if that counts. And we have one coming up very soon at Lincoln Center with Ethan Hawke. And now this one was announced, although the Kenneth Branagh one is not till the spring of 2014.
June 2014, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe by that time, I don't know, maybe people will.
In a 55,000 square foot Wade Thompson drill hall. 55,000 square feet. That's, I wonder if they're going to iris down that stage, you know?
Well, yeah. Well, to be fair about these things, though, you know, I mean, it's different for us. We see everything. But I mean, the point is, it's very easy for people who want to see Macbeth to say, oh, I've got to get over to the Barrymore and see Alan Cumming. And then suddenly time passes and you missed him.
Sure.
And, you know, and here we go. We're going to have another production and people are going to say, oh, I've got to get there. And they're going to miss that one, too. And so as a result, the idea of people having a lot more chances, the actual public having the chance to see these shows is something that they may appreciate more than we do. And who do they do it for? They do it for the public. So as a result, this may not be such a bad thing. And, you know, it's fun to collect performances and see what people do differently. And Lord knows Kenneth Branagh is a terrific actor. So as a result, the idea to have a chance to see him is one we should celebrate, even if it comes on the heels of another production a little too quickly. So I'm glad he's coming to town.
And kind of interesting to me, because I'm sure I've said before, I have a very low opinion of Rob Ashford as a director, as opposed to as a choreographer. But the idea of him directing Kenneth Branagh, well, you know, maybe that's the point. I mean, Kenneth Branagh has done an awful lot of directing himself. So I do wonder exactly who's going to be, pulling the strings of this production.
You know, and for a lot of these things, we're seeing Macbeth, but I think a lot of people are actually going to see Kenneth Branagh and Ethan Hawke and Alan Cumming. They're really...
Oh, sure. Yeah.
A lot of those things. But you had mentioned the point that, is public domain. But, you know, I'd like to see a lot more Gilbert and Sullivan, which is also in the public domain, you know?
I guess that's more expensive.
Well, parenthetically, a friend of mine, I won't get into it because I didn't see it, but he just saw a production of The Importance of Being Ernest Hemingway.
Uh-huh.
Did you see it? Well, I mean, to be very brief, and again, I didn't see it, but apparently it was The Importance of Being Ernest done in the style of Ernest Hemingway with actual Hemingway prose interpolated into it. And at any rate, I mean, he, my friend did not like it, but regardless of that, the point being that, I guess that Wild, you know, I mean, is something else that is now certainly, I assume, totally in the public domain. So, that's somebody else people can turn to. And as the years go by, you know, some of our greatest works may or may not go into public domain, because now, as I think we all know, first of all, I think copyrights are being extended longer than they used to be. But on top of that, we have a situation whereby people are doing revised versions of things as a way to keep them out of the public domain. So it's going to be very interesting to see how that proceeds over the next years and decades.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah,
I understand, this may not be true, but I understand the Disney people have really worked very hard to extend copyrights because they don't want that Mickey Mouse out in the public domain. And so a lot of lobbying has gone on as a result of what they've wanted to do. If you find out tomorrow that's not true at all, don't be surprised, but it is
yes.
Something I've heard.
No, absolutely. And I believe that it was actually stated by some of the people involved with this most recent hateful Porgy and Bess revisal, that one of the impetuses,
right.
If
yeah.
not the impetus, was to keep that version of it, at least the new version of it, you know, out of the public domain.
Well, the great Wikipedia confirms what Peter is saying about Mickey Mouse in the public domain now.
Really?
Who knows if it's correct or not, but Wikipedia is becoming more and more accurate these days. So
I agree entirely.
So, speaking of public domain, and Gilbert and Sullivan, the Pirates of Penzance and Linda Ronstadt had some news this week that she's suffering from Parkinson's disease, and that's some sad news. But I go back and I listen to that. The cast recording of Pirates, and people out there that hate it, I love that recording of Pirates. What do you guys think?
I do too.
Yes, and people have. I was just watching the film version of it, the actual film, which was in which Angela Lansbury played Ruth. But other than that, it's practically the exact same cast of the stage production. But as I think we mentioned, a couple of years ago, they unearthed a live taping from the Delacorte of the original production of the
Ruth.
Yeah, with Patricia Rutledge and Breck Smith and Linda Ronstadt and George Rose. And the bad news is that technically it's really not that great. Some parts of it are better than others, but it's still so fantastic to see this little time capsule of this really amazing experience in the park. She really was something. I mean, she had this freaky head voice that she really could go up there, you know. I mean, I don't know how strong it was, but when amplified, it certainly sounded very strong. And she, I mean, look, let's face it. I mean, that production wouldn't have been nowhere near as popular and as successful if not for her star presence. She also famously did those recordings of standards with Nelson Riddle, the most famous of which I believe is called What's New, and gave a whole new life to these really incredible classics, songs from, you know, such as It Never Entered My Mind, that incredible Rodgers and Hart song, and Skylark, which isn't a show tune, but it's a great standard by Hoagy Carmichael. So she really, you know, she really, you have to hand it to her for really pushing herself and not just staying in her rut, you know, as incredibly successful and popular as it may be, but really branching out into other kinds of music. And I really think she deserves all the credit in the world for that.
So in other news this week, we have the fact that Tyne Daly is returning to the Broadway stage. So what do you think about coming back?
Wonderful. I'm delighted. She's always terrific. And the Terrence McNally play that happened in Bucks County, where she did it there. Everybody I know who saw it, I did not, told me it was terrific. I have a tough time with Bucks County because of parking. So I have to admit that that discourages me from going there. And I know you've been there, James, and I know you had the same experience. So you know where I'm talking about as far as that's concerned. But that said, there is no question that the idea of Tyne Daly coming back into Terrence McNally play with good word of mouth is a very exciting prospect for Broadway.
The show I neglected to say is Mothers and Sons, and as Peter mentioned, this is what had a premiere engagement at Bucks County, which has excellent ice cream parlor down the block from it. I love ice cream. So that's going to be good, and we also see that Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is heading for a Broadway run with Sam Mendes. And it seems like this next season is already mounting up to be very, very busy in March and April already. So,
I was walking past the Broadway Theater. I wish they changed that place name. Because it's so generic. But anyway, they have all those three sheets on the sides. Yeah. And it was really something to see the bullets over Broadway three sheet up already saying March 11th. I mean, you know, that's still a way away, but they're whetting our appetite for it now. So, and that's more and more common. Shows that are really months and months away start getting the appetite whetted. I mean, think of that big sign between 45th and 46th Street on the side of the building for Matilda that was up a long time before the show came to town. And things are happening.
Speaking of front of house placement, I don't think this is a three sheet, but this is kind of amazing. Somebody posted a photo today, I think. I think it was on All That Chat, of a poster that it apparently is in, as we speak, is in front of the Majestic Theater for Phantom of the Opera, and it says that it stars Hugo Panero.
Oh yeah, I did. Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah.
So, proofreading is becoming a lost art, I think.
Well, you know, as people rush, you know, mistakes are made in the last...
How long was he in it? I mean, he's coming back. How long was he in it? Five years?
Yeah, good point.
Five years as the Phantom, and he had another couple of years as Raoul.
Yeah.
And things like that. So Bridges of Madison County, we mentioned, was at the Williamstown Theater Festivals. Now got a Broadway opening date of February 27th. And Bartlett Scher is directing it with who's starring in it? Stephen Pasquale and Kelly O'Hara. That's right.
but not up there. It's Elena's Shadow.
Right.
Oh, that's right.
Elena's Shadow.
She's with child. You know, I was going to ask Amanda Green what month she was born, because I believe she was born in 65, which was when her mother was doing Pleasures and Palaces, the show that closed in Detroit. And I wonder how far along Phyllis Newman was when, or if she was pregnant at all, you know, when Pleasures and Palaces were trying out in January, February there, you know, so there was, it's still possible, you know, that she wasn't even pregnant yet. But I was curious about that. But good taste ruled the day, and I didn't ask her.
Also, in the news, we have sad news that Julie Harris passed away, and it's such a tremendous loss to the Broadway community. And lots of people posted on Facebook and Twitter really wonderful remembrances of her. Have you guys got anything to say, Peter?
Well, the first time I saw Julie Harris, and this won't surprise many people, was in a musical, and that was Skyscraper, the only musical she ever did. And she got a Tony nomination for it, and that might have been a lifetime achievement type thing, but I can tell you, I thought she was terrific in the show. I thought she was really fine, and I always applaud these actresses like Lauren Bacall and Katharine Hepburn and Vivien Leigh, who say, yes, I'm a dramatic actress. Yes, I've been acclaimed for my dramatic prowess, but nevertheless, I want to do a musical. I want that experience. And I'm sure she was very, very glad she did it, because She certainly made a friendship with Charles Nelson Reilly that lasted right up to his death. And as he told the story, this may not be new to many of you because he loved telling the story. He came into Detroit when Skyscraper was in trouble, and he replaced an actor named Victor Spinetti, who you can still see in the Hard Day's Night movie, the Beatles movie, and had already won a Tony for Oh, What a Lovely War. So this was an acclaimed actor, and yet they decided to make a change, and so Charles Nelson Reilly came in, and they're rehearsing now. And of course, you know a musical in tryout. Pages come in, pages come out, songs come in, songs come out. So anyway, they're rehearsing, and Julie Harris fumbles. She loses her place. And Charles Nelson Reilly looks out to Cy Fewer, the producer, and says, "Cy, where did you get her?" And luckily, you know, which really says that she's a great lady, she thought it was hilarious as opposed to get off the stage, you're fired, you know, which certainly we know many stars would have had that reaction. Excuse me, I'm the power here. But she thought it was hilarious. And he directed her many, many times in the years to come in a terrific friendship. So that was the first time I saw her. I also saw her in The Last of Mrs. Lincoln, in which she was terrific as well, playing, of course, Mrs. Lincoln. And I still remember very vividly there was a scene in which a little boy, I think was, it might have been a girl, but it was a little kid, who said, "I think the only two great presidents in this country were George Washington and Abraham Lincoln." And the way Julie Harris looked at him and said, "And I'm not so sure about Washington," was great. You know, it was really such a nice moment. So The Belle of Amherst, too, I was very lucky to see it dead center from a front row seat. She was in front of me the whole night at the Colonial Theater in Boston, and what an experience that was, you know, because she really had Emily Dickinson down pat. So yeah, and you know, I'll tell you, if you've never seen the movie of I Am a Camera, it's almost painful how good she is. There's a scene where she wants to go into a restaurant, and Lawrence Harvey says, we need this money for the rent. Oh, one drink. Well, it's more than one drink, as it turns out, I'm telling you. And the way she is thrilled that the food just keeps on, they just keep on bringing food to the table. And she says, "Yes, I'll have that. It was supposed to be one drink." And they spend the rent money. And he is so upset while she's just having the time of her life. She does not get the fact that reality is going to hit. She does that so perfectly. The first time I ever saw her, though, was in the movie of Member of the Wedding. I remember it so vividly, being in my parents' house, in my bedroom. It was one of the first UHS stations to play in Boston. They were playing all these old movies that you couldn't see anywhere else. I was in heaven, you know, because they were doing all these Broadway adaptations. And watching that performance, and years later to hear that she was so much older, because she really was very convincing to me. I'll grant you, I'm not necessarily saying I thought she was 12, but I certainly thought she was younger than she was.
24, apparently.
Yeah. So and what a magical thing a Member of the Wedding is across the board. All three of them are terrific in it. But it's one of my favorite lines of all time when she talks about running away and becoming an actress and saying something like, "Well, if worse comes to worse, I'll even play comedy." You know, like there are going to be so many opportunities, you know, for her that she really believes that's the worst that's going to happen, that she's going to have to play in a comedy, you know, that we all know that you're lucky if you get a part in anything. But here she is thinking that the world is going to open up and welcome her with such open arms that but just in case it doesn't, well, she obviously has comedy to fall back on, you know, and she'll deign to do a comedy. But God bless Julie Harris for deigning to do a musical. And, you know, think of it. I mean, 40 Carats she even got a Tony for. I didn't see her do it. But that's a commercial comedy, Abe Burrows, you know, I mean, really, I mean, the fact that she could get, it's a Tony for a role like that about an older woman who falls in love with a younger man and is petrified about the ramifications of that. I mean, that's not the type of play you get a Tony for, except when you're Julie Harris, you do.
Well, my only personal anecdote of her is that I was working at In Theater Magazine right around the time when she opened in, I guess, her last Broadway show, which was The Gin Game with Charles Durning. And so we got a whole bunch of people who were in shows that season to post for this large photo at Sardi's. It was probably like 20 or 25 people, you know, who were starring in shows then. And she was one of them. And of course, she's, you know, an acclaimed dramatic and comedic actress on film and stage and television. And she's tied for the record of number of Tony Awards with Gwen Verdon. Isn't that right?
What about Angela Lansbury, right? She has five as well. Are you well? Yeah, I think so.
Oh, I thought I read six for.
Oh yeah.
I think it's six for Gwen and Miss Harris and Miss Lansbury's right just right behind them. But I'll have to double check that. But at any rate, I mean, obviously one of the most acclaimed dramatic and comedic actresses of our time, and yet she did do the musical. So I don't know exactly what possessed me, but when I spoke to her, when I got to speak to her at that photo shoot, I said, "Miss Harris, would you ever consider doing another musical?" And she said, "Well, you're talking about Skyscraper, aren't you?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "Yes, I am." And she said, and I loved her answer. She was, "Well, if the right role came along," mm-hmm. You know, never say no. And she really was. She really was. I was just listening to it the other day. I didn't see the show, but the cast album is quite delightful. And she's,
I think so too.
Thoroughly, thoroughly delightful on it.
She won five. She has six because they gave her a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Oh,
in
2002. Okay.
So, not to be confused with the 2005 Drama Desk Lifetime Achievement Award. So, thank God that we definitely appreciated her. In fact, it's really interesting to think that she won more times than she lost, because she was the time she didn't win were for Skyscraper, and that was the year that Angela Lansbury did Mame. So, come on. She also was nominated for Marathon 33. In the 63-64 season that I'm writing about, and playing essentially June Havoc, and what it was like after she left Rose and Louise and became a marathon dancer. And she was also nominated for the Au Pair Man way back in 74, a funky play, as well as Lucifer's Child. But I mean, the point is five wins out of nine. The World Series used to be five out of nine. So, I mean, she won the World Series. It did, back in the old days. You know, it wasn't four out of seven, it was five out of nine. So, so she won the World Series.
Well, Peter, you know, I have a few questions for you. Mm-hmm. First of all, is that I don't think you mentioned it, maybe I missed it when I was reading, was that she won the 1949 Theater World Award for Sundown Beach.
That's right.
Did you mention that? I missed that.
Or, no, I didn't say that. No, yes, which makes her one of the first Theater World Award winners, because they started in 45 and she did win in 49. And again, you know, there's Daniel Blum. This is even before John Willis was doing it. Daniel Blum was really smart in seeing some of these people and saying, whoa, she's really got something. Because really, what's Sundown Beach? I mean, have you ever heard of it? You know, it ran seven performances. You know, I mean, and there were a million people in the cast, as there were in those days. And look what happened, you know. So.
Oh, and get this. In 1948, she played a witch in Macbeth on Broadway.
Look at that.
Oh, can you imagine?
So tell me about the 76 and 77 Tony Awards. Oh, I'm reading this wrong on the IBDB. It's got the, in 1976, she won the Drama Desk Award for Unique Theatrical Experience for The Belle of Amherst. And then in 77, she won Best Actress in a Play for the Tony Award for The Belle of Amherst. So it seemed like
years, because it opened in late April. In those days, the Tony cutoff was April 15th. Mm-hmm. So the Drama Desk went a little later. And there's a lot of that going on. I mean, you'll see that from time to time, that holdovers from the previous season do make their presence known in one and not the other because of the different cutoff dates. It's a little more symmetrical now, I'm happy to say. And I think it should be, you know, so that really doesn't happen. And yet, on the other hand, what's wrong with giving, you know, celebrating a performance 2 years in a row? Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that you got up at two lecterns and got to thank people and tell a story or two, great. That's all right, too. I think I'm going to take back my symmetrical thing just for situations like this where she was able to get two chances to be lauded in two consecutive years.
All right. So a few things before we go. I wanted to mention that right now we're recording on a Monday night. It's August 26th. And Broadway Week is coming up September 2nd through the 15th, where you can get some two-for-one tickets. And I will include a link in the show notes to Broadway Week so that if you are inclined to see a few shows from the 2nd to the 15th, you can perhaps pick up some two-for-ones.
Similarly speaking, Off-Broadway has that $20 deal where 20 minutes before the curtain, mm-hmm. you can get into many, I'm not saying all necessarily, but many Off-Broadway shows for $20, 20 minutes before the curtain. And that's running from September 3rd to, I think, the 20th, maybe 22nd, something like that. But that's worth paying attention to as well. It means, I don't know if it's sold out. Harbor has 1 week to play during that period of time, and I think Harbor's awfully good. So if you can get into Harbor, I would recommend that highly.
Yeah, Harbor over at 59 East 59, Chad Beglin.
They closed on the 8th, so there's only 1 week of that. And I'm not optimistic, given how good it is, that there are going to be tickets available. But at least it's worth a phone call to check out and let people tell you if you have any chance at all.
And right after we finished recording last week, we got the press release that Let It Be is going to be closing. So if you are a Beatles fan and you're interested in seeing that, you should get down and see that as soon as possible. I think it's only got a couple of days left. I think this weekend is the final performance.
The related news that's
really surprising to me is that theater, the St. James, is going to be the home of the Broadway transfer of Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet.
Yeah, temporarily, yeah. Absolutely.
It does seem to me that if you're a Beatles fan, you might not want to go to Let It Be, but that's another story.
You know, that's a very good point. It's a very good point.
Apparently, their numbers have been just really quite horrendous, so I'm surprised it's even going that long.
Tangential to that is that somebody who I knew for a number of years, Sid Bernstein, who brought the Beatles to America.
Did you know him?
Yeah,
oh,
I
know
Sid Bernstein.
Yeah.
Sid Bernstein passed away this week. Oh. And he was just the greatest lover of all people, all music, all arts and things like that, and a tremendous supporter of everybody. And he will be sorely missed, but I think Sid was 93 or so.
Yeah, thank God it was a good long life. The one thing is, I agree with you, James. I will tell you, though I never met him, never dealt with him for a tenth of a second, I never heard anybody say anything beyond superlatives and such excitement over who he was and everything that he did and what a nice person he was. So yes, we do want him to rest in peace.
But couldn't have been a nicer person.
So
just giving of everybody for the man who brought the Beatles to America, to, you know, he would never brag about the things that he has ever done. You'd have to ask him and really prod and find out what he did, because he was always talking about, hey, what's the next thing I'm going to do? Mm-hmm. Now, up until his death this week. Wonderful, wonderful man. All right. So anything coming up for you guys this week that we should mention beforehand, or shall we roll the dice?
Roll the dice.
All righty.
Well, I did just want to say quickly that we were, I guess, remiss in not noting the death of Edie Gourmet.
Yes, I'm sorry I didn't mention that. Yeah.
Only, well, I mean, aside from everything, she was such a great singer. But I just find it interesting that in the mid to late 60s, she had quite big hits with not one but two Broadway songs. If You Walked Into My Life from Mame, and What Did I Have That I Don't Have from On a Clear Day.
Terrific recordings.
Absolutely fantastic. And then she also did, the other interesting thing for our purposes is that she and her husband Steve Lawrence did a show called Golden Rainbow, which didn't run all that long, but and I think at the time was considered very second or even third rate, you know, kind of a vehicle for them. But I am telling you, if you put on that album now and you listen to it, it's just terrific. I mean, I think it's so it may not be compared to the great shows of its time. It may not be quite up there, but it's a whole lot better than a lot of stuff that we've seen since then. And it's just, you know, it's the type of music that is perfect for that story, you know, set in Las Vegas. And she, her opening number is this fantastic song called He Needs Me. She's playing, she's the aunt, and she's coming to rescue this kid from his father, who's supposed to be a terrible influence. And it's you know, she sings the hell out of it, and it's a great song. And I just think people should give a listen to Golden Rainbow to see how something that really at the time, a show that was really sort of dismissed, can really, you know, some of them really hold up better than others.
I have never met anybody who's interested in Broadway who was not totally 100% in love with the song For Once in Your Life from Golden Rainbow. That's the one that everybody gets intoxicated by. So, and don't forget, you know, if she wanted to, she could have done Flora the Red Menace. She could have done Funny Girl.
Yep.
The offers were out there.
Yep.
You know, and a lot of people say what it was is she knew her limitations, that she knew that she was not a great actress and those roles would be beyond her. And because the role in Golden Rainbow was not the leading role, her husband's role was. So as a result, it fell more on him than it did on her. So so she felt a little more secure there, and knowing also too that people would want to see Steve and Edie, you know. So
right.
So there's that too. So. Yes, indeed. You know, the other one that I loved that she did during that period of time, too, by the way, she did the title song of Do I Hear a Waltz as a single, and it's a terrific recording as well. Terrific. Mm. You know, so so if you can track any of these down, make sure it happens.
All right. So with that, I will wrap up here. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a link there. And that way you can subscribe in iTunes. That way each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you'd like to listen to us in other ways, you can listen to us on the Stitcher app. That's an app you can get on your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and stream This Week on Broadway directly to you. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. At BroadwayRadio.com, we have show notes. That way you can see links to some of the things we've talked about today, and also have contact information for Peter, Michael, and me. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You and life can skip the strife and you'll both get along. All it takes is simply saying you're wrong. When you're wrong, he may say it's really great to be, but it is a sorry state to be, and I kinda, sorta hate to be wrong.